Okay, so I don't think I can find another Jewish ritual that's as the Jews obsess over as much as Passover. And I don't just mean practically. The Torah itself obsesses over Passover. Just throw out some stuff. When do we make references to the Exodus from Egypt in our prayer? What context? In the prayers, where?
Amidah.
It's referenced in the Amidah, not as explicitly, but it's explicitly mentioned in the Shema. Third paragraph, the whole third paragraph. When else did we mention the Exodus? Kiddush every Friday night. In fact, it's one of the two reasons the Torah gives for keeping Shabbos. To remember that you were once a slave and then God took you out. When else do we remember the Exodus? What other times? When we bench, Berkat HaMazon, grace after meals. And on top of all that, we've got this crazy holiday. Does anybody know how many? There are 613 mitzvot. 8 of them pertain just to chametz. Okay? I haven't even talked about like the mitzvah to have a carbon Pesach, the mitzvah to tell over the story. No, I think, 5 of them having to do with chametz. You can't eat chametz, you can't possess chametz, you can't own chametz, you can't have benefit from chametz. We just spoke about this. If you have a pet, you can't feed your pet chametz, because even though you're not eating it, you're getting benefit, because an owner gets benefit. This is what I learned with David Lichtenstein on Shabbat. Actually, I was in his synagogue, and he gave a whole thing, like, what do you do with the pet? I said, there's no chametz in pet food. And some guy in the shul was like, yeah, my pet food has chametz in it. It has grains. So what do you do? So his theory is that you not only sell the chametz that you're giving the pet, you sell the pet. So you don't even own the pet. And I'm like, how many Gentiles know when they're buying chametz that they're also getting like a cat, a dog, like hundreds of them? Because, I mean, it sounds funny, but so we go to great, great lengths. And the question is why? Can anyone just suggest anything that we kind of touched on when we spoke about Shabbat a little? Why do we obsess so much? What is it about the Exodus moment that is so fundamental in Jewish philosophy and Jewish tradition that we have 8 days devoted to this and all these rules and laws? What's that?
Jewish people? Like when we got out of slavery, that's when we officially started.
We started as a nation. It did develop us as a nation. That's true. Yeah?
We went from an idol-worshipping society.
We went from an idol-worshipping... Well, we were idol-worshippers in Egypt. That's true.
And we went to freedom and to receive the Torah.
Okay, so the point of getting out of Egypt was eventually to get to the Torah. But let's just cut it off even before we get to the Torah. What is it about getting freed that's so important?
God intervenes in worldly affairs.
Okay. Were you going to say that?
Active hand.
Active hand in what? That's the bottom line. Active hand in history. Albert Einstein believed in a God of creation, but didn't necessarily believe in what we would call a personal God. A personal God is a God that is involved in our lives. Now, I can't, and this is complicated, because it's not as though I can tell you when exactly God is doing something in your life or he's not. I just told this crazy story to the class before and about something that happened in Gaza.
RPG.
Yeah, oh, right, you were just here. I'm sorry. It was, right, Yossi Levine just told me that somebody was collecting money for lone soldiers in Israel. His tank unit, it was this one guy who was trying to get everyone to put on tefillin in the unit. And it was this one guy, very hesitant to put on the tefillin. Mm-hmm. So he says, look, I'll take you out to dinner. If you put on tefillin right now, I'll take you out to dinner tonight. He's like, free dinner? I'll put the tefillin on. He's starting to wrap the tefillin. And the sun gets in his eye. And he's having a hard time concentrating. So he yells to his buddy, they were in a tank unit. He yells to his buddy on the tank, can you just back the tank up a little? Block the sun, I get a little shade. The guy pulls the tank back a few yards. The second he does, an RPG comes whizzing by. And misses the tank, misses the whole crew. And they find the terrorist and they take him out. The two guys killed the terrorist. And he's telling my friend like the story, and it's like everybody's looking like, where's God since October 7th? And he's there, but it's not always there. You know? And there are those moments where you get a little glimpse and, you know, a little reminder that Hashem didn't just create the world, but he's continuing He's making sure that the world continues. And I said this just literally a few minutes ago at the tail end of class. This is a basic idea in Kabbalah, in Jewish mystical tradition, that God, if God stops pumping his spiritual energy into the world stops. It reverts back to its primordial chaos. And the Baal HaTanya, one of the great Hasidic masters, he likened our relationship to God as like a child in utero to its mother. How conscious is any child in utero that it is being completely supported and sustained by its mother through the umbilical cord? Nothing. And that's kind of the way we go through life. You can't see God. You can't experience God with any of the senses. So we just sort of like, oh, you know. But the second Hashem stops intervening, stops being involved, is the second that everything stops. Everything. Life as we know it. But I can't prove that to you. That's our belief. Now, how do you drum home a belief? Ritualize it. Mm-hmm. Put it into action. Because I can say this idea 10 times, but if you eat a lot of matzah and you stay away from chametz, you might actually start feeling the idea. Because what's matzah and chametz really? Matzah is a positive way of reinforcing this idea, and chametz is a negative way. Because what's matzah represent?
Humility.
It represents humility. How does matzah represent humility? It's flat. It's not bloated. It's not filled with itself. And it represents what? Why do we eat matzah? What's the reason the Torah gives us for eating matzah?
Because there wasn't enough time for the...
Yeah. And why is that important? Think about that for a minute. Why is it important that there wasn't enough time for the bread to rise? Like, who cares? So we left in a rush. We didn't leave in a rush. What do you think? What does it show? It demonstrates something very simple. Mm-hmm. This was not some sort of revolutionary movement. Like the Hanukkah story. This is not the Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story is that we push back against the Greeks. Did the Jews push back against the Egyptians? No. God sent Moshe. He pushed back against the Egyptians. Moshe didn't even want to do it. God kept, you know, had to twist his arm. So what does matzah come to represent? The fact that we left in a rush? It shows that what? That who's behind this event? That Hashem is behind the event. What's chametz? What's chametz?
Ego.
Physicality.
Physicality, because it's filled, it's puffed up. With what? With itself. And it's the idea that, no, I'm calling all the shots. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who is making life happen as we know it. I don't say this prayer, but there's some chassidim that say a prayer. You know, we're going to have the night of Bedika. I'm going to talk about it in a few minutes. You know, the search for leaven. When do we do that search? We do it the night before Passover. When's Passover? It's a week from Monday night. So the search is going to be a week from Sunday night. And there's a prayer that some people say as they look for the chametz outside, that I'm not just looking for the chametz out there, I'm also looking for the chametz in here. The part of me that disregards anything else that's operating in this world. It's all me. I make all the decisions, whatever I say goes, and there's no other force that's actually operational in the world. Now, it takes a little faith to believe in that. But the way to drum home and the way to get that faith to be part of us, ultimately, is to ritualize it and to stay away from certain things and consume other things. So we consume, welcome, we consume the matzah and we stay away from the chametz. So take a look at the hand that I just gave out. I wrote this up, you can take this. I literally wrote notes for you over here. Passover commemorates the redemption of the Jewish people from slavery. Look at the second paragraph. The Jews were taken out of Egypt in such a haste that the bread they were baking did not have time to rise. And this demonstrates that they did not plan their escape. Because if they did plan their escape, you think they'd be involved in something as mundane as baking bread? No, they would have been trying to leave. So the redemption was accomplished by God. And that's what the matzah comes to symbolize. And chametz is just the opposite. Please, thank you. Chametz, by the way, you know what's interesting? What's the only difference between chametz and matzah, technically? Physically. What is chametz physically and what's matzah? The only difference is time. Because in order to make matzah, you have to take one of the five grains and make sure it doesn't rise. So you have to pull it out of the oven before 18 minutes. Also, you guys go to, there's a matzah baking thing next week. You're going to see the way they do it. It's very, very cool. but it's very quick. They put it in super thin. They have to make sure it doesn't. Sometimes they have to throw out pieces if it's not, if they think it fermented a little. That's why shmur matzah is very expensive. I'm going to talk about that. It's just that they guard the matzah from an earlier period of time, from the time of Shas Ktsira, the Talmud says, from the time that they harvest it in the field, they make sure, but that it didn't ferment, it didn't. And chametz is just the opposite. What's chametz? Any one of the five grains that did ferment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the only difference is time, and that's another lesson of the holiday, which is what? The slave doesn't own their own time. And when we were freed, we were given the opportunity to spend time, which is a very, very important idea. We shouldn't drive ourselves crazy, but the idea of killing time is not a very Jewish concept, right? Time is, who did I just hear? I saw some real uber wealthy guy, I forgot his name, said, look, I've blown a lot of money, probably stupidly. He says, but time, I take time very seriously. Money you can always get back. Time you can never get back. And that's why the first mitzvah that God gave the Jewish people when they were redeemed, Rosh Chodesh, time to be able to, actually Rabbi Lichtenstein last week gave a beautiful talk about the moon, that why the Jewish people are compared to the moon and not the sun, because the moon's always waxing and waning, it never stays the same, it's always grooving, moving and grooving, always growing, it's, the sun is just, you know, it rises and it sets, but it's always, it remains the same. But the idea of time, there's such powerful ideas that Passover expresses. But to really feel the ideas, we try as best as we can to live them and to actually express them in what's called halakha. So we want to get rid of chametz. How do you get rid of it? What do you do? A couple of steps. First of all, get rid of it. Do you have to get rid of all your chametz?
No.
Anybody know? You heard some of this already. So let's get somebody else. What do you do? What can you do if you don't want to throw out all the chametz you have in your home? What can you do?
Put it away.
And but you still have, if you put it, you have to sell it. What happens if you just put it away and you don't eat it? So good, you follow that commandment of not eating chametz, but you still
in possession.
Still in your possession, which means you still own it. So you have to relinquish ownership. Now you only need to relinquish ownership of your chametz. Like if you go to work and your Jewish or non-Jewish friend is munching down on a, I don't know, a devil dog, whatever it is, choose your chametz. You don't have to like, you know, flick the devil dog out of his hand and like, what are you doing? Okay, it's not your chametz. You don't own it. As long as you don't own it, it's fine. Which is one of the reasons we do what's called a bittul. We verbally annul any possession of chametz. We take 4 or 5 steps. And we do this whole search and destroy kind of mission of the chametz. I'm going to go through it with you now. Okay, it's very, very simple. We clean out our homes and our places of work, right? And any chametz food that we don't want to get rid of, you can just put away somewhere in your apartment or wherever you live, or just seal it up. And that's the stuff you'll sell. And you can just fill out this form. You're going to give me this form, and I'm going to give it to Rabbi Levine. He's the rabbi of the Jewish Center. He gives it to Rabbi Willig, and Rabbi Willig sells like tens of thousands of Jewish people's chametz to some nice Gentile man who buys the chametz every year. And it sounds like a joke. It's not a joke. This person owns your chametz, so if you would eat the chametz that you sold, you would not only be in violation of eating chametz, but you'd be stealing, because it's not yours. There's one rabbi on the west side that still asks people for their keys. When I was a kid, they used to ask people for their keys, because the Gentile should have access to your chametz. He's buying it from you. He should be able to get into the apartment and eat his food whenever he wants. But, okay, you're uncomfortable with that. But Rabbi Levine doesn't require that. You just write, and you write your address down. So that way we know where it is. And if you're out of town, you put your number so that that person could theoretically call you and say, hey, I'd like to be able to eat some of that. It's not going to happen. Okay, but theoretically, in order for the sale to be real, it has to be, you know. So you could fill this out, and there's a...
If you're out of town, do you still have to do the search for the chametz before you
go? If you leave for the entire holiday,
yeah.
So what I do, because I'm leaving for the entire holiday, is I pick one room in my home that has very little, so it's easy for me, because I'm crazy ready. And I do a bedika, which is a search in that room, just so I can fulfill the mitzvah of searching. Right. Now the custom, and I'm going to continue with this, is to place 10 pieces of bread when you do your search. Anybody know why? I don't know why 10, by the way, if anybody has a theory. Why 10? But why do you put some pieces of bread around? Think for a minute. You're going to make a bracha before you start the search. And you want to make sure that what?
You're not using God's name in vain.
Yeah, which could be
if you don't find
you don't find any chametz. We don't play with God's name. Right? So put a few pieces of bread, gather them up, and then what do you do immediately after you gather those 10 pieces of bread? This is Sunday night now. Now, if you're not home the night before Passover, when do you do this? The night before that. Except you only can do a bracha the night before. But you still can do the bedikah. I'm leaving Sunday, so I'm going to do the bedikah Saturday night. The bedikah means the search. Very, very important. Bedikah is to search. Very important. Take a look on the next page. Actually, two pages down in this little packet here. Very, very important. I tell everyone to do this. You do what's called a bittul. Bittul means to verbally nullify. Okay, and it's operational in a legal sense. You verbally, after you search for your chametz, you're going to do two bittuls. One is right after the search, and then the other one is the next day after the burning. Read it with me, just on the bottom. Any chametz or leaven that's in my possession, whether I have recognized it or not, whether I have seen it or not, whether I have removed it or not, should be annulled and become ownerless like the dust of the earth. What does that do? What does that accomplish? Why do we do that? What do you think?
You're verbally giving up ownership if you miss something.
Right, so what happens if you find chametz in the middle of Passover? And this happens, by the way. I get calls all the time.
You
Rabbi, I found
it.
Some chametz. What's that?
You sold it.
You sold it. It's not yours. So what do you do with the chametz then?
Throw it out.
Throw it away.
So there's a big debate, and Rabbi Litzin was discussing this last week. If it's during Chol HaMoed, you should burn it or flush it down the toilet. If you find it on Yom Tov, on the holiday, what do you do then? It's muksa. You can't really move it. So just cover it. And you're just covering it so you don't inadvertently...
Well, you can't move it within your home too, because you can. The only way you can't move
right,
stuff
we talked
is
about,
like outside.
Right, unless it's something that you're not supposed to move. But anything that has no function or purpose on Shabbat cannot be moved. It becomes, by definition, muksa. We didn't get to talk about that.
I have a question.
Oh. Yeah.
So I'm on your schedule. Like, I'm working on Pesach program.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, my two roommates are also going to be away for the entire time. So, like, I do keep coming to my room, my bedroom. So why does my chametz in my bedroom have to now get moved elsewhere?
It doesn't. Is anyone staying in your bedroom?
No.
Huh.
So everything could stay as is?
Yeah, you just...
I was told I had to put it in a box or like...
Just close your... Lock your door then. If no one's coming in, just close the door. It's fine. There's no difference. There's no ritual of a box. You know what I mean? Like, you just want to have it contained in one area.
But not... So like, for example, we have the pantry and the kitchen.
Right.
And then I do keep a few items in my room.
That's okay.
That's fine.
Yeah. Oh. As long as no one is staying in
no
the room.
No one's going to be in there.
It's fine. You can just leave it there. It's not, by the way, I just want to say something. It's not as crazy as... It's not like so hard. It's like... It's just a little of attention to detail, but it's not like... It's not meant to be impossible. To make... And people... You know, I saw this video of some guy preparing for Passover, but he was cleaning the toilet seat cover. And it was all this like Jewish music playing. He's getting ready for Pesach and he's cleaning the toilet seat. So I'm like, most people who see that are like, oh, I got to clean the toilet seat. Why? Unless you have, you know, 3-course meals while you're sitting on the toilet, which is like, you don't have to clean the bathroom. Now, you might want to clean your bathroom anyway. That's
but
advisable.
In the example of going to Florida,
yeah,
and you go into your hotel room, how do you not know that there isn't?
You have to do a little bedikah the night before in your hotel room before Passover starts, yeah. Yeah. You don't have to do it with a blessing or anything like that because you don't really own it. It's not yours. So I do a bedikah. I just look around the room and just make sure there's no food in there.
Couldn't you say it's expected that your program probably did that?
As a rabbi in one of these programs, I will tell you, don't assume.
No, I'm trying to prepare for my
Yeah, no, no, you can't assume. You can't assume. It takes 5 minutes. Just look around. How big are the hotel rooms?
Yeah, but you have to come with the bread.
With the what?
You have to come with bread, right?
You don't have to. You don't do it with a bracha. It's not your facility. I would do it without a blessing.
So no bread?
You don't have to use the bread. Just do it without. Just do a bedikah, which means look.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You're only doing the bread because you're making a bracha, because you don't want to take God's name for vain, in vain in case you didn't find anything. Follow? There's a logic to this whole thing. Making sense? Yeah?
I thought you were going to say the sixth thing is going to Florida. Though,
My rabbi, blessed memory, Rabbi Grunblatt, used to say that it wasn't meant to chase Jews to the Catskills. That's where all the Jews used to go before air travel became common. Everyone went to the Catskills, and now they flee to Florida. I mean, I'm a hypocrite. I'm going there so my family can have a nice time. I'll be working, mind you. You have no idea how much I'm working on this place.
Is this on tape?
Yeah, everybody should know. I get no break. Okay, it's a nice hotel. Fine.
It's beautiful.
Were you able to say your stuff will be dust of the earth multiple times, so you were saying doing the bitul twice. There's no maximum amount of bitulling
how many times you need to do it?
Well, like if you're going to like your office, like at work, or like
you do it once for all your chametz. Yeah, covers everything.
You don't have to be in. So then why would you need to do it in your hotel room if
you don't do a bitul? A bidika you do. Bidika is done. Okay, difference between a bidika, I want everyone to know this. What's the word bidika? Means to search. Bitul means to nullify. Why do you think you have to do multiple searches but not multiple nullifications?
Bitul means nullified?
Because if you have different, if you're in different places, then you have to do more than one search.
You're doing a search to make sure there's no food lying around. So if you have multiple homes, you got to check if you're there, if you're going to be there for Passover. If you're not going to be there for Passover and you're going to Florida, then you don't need to do it. So that was your question. So, but a bitul, it really covers everything. But we do it twice. We do once after the search, which is next Sunday night. Not this Sunday night, the week after Sunday night. And then we do another bitul after the burning. Because there's actually a mitzvah from the Torah to burn your chametz.
Do you physically need to, do the bitul versus having someone do it for you?
You should do the bitul yourself, but you can give your chametz to someone else to burn if you need. You can appoint somebody as your... What's that?
So, I'm going to also be away...
I take my chametz with me. I bring it in my knapsack on the plane, and then I do a burning at the hotel with all the people there.
I don't have my bitul.
You just burn it. Don't you guys like playing with matches? It's fun.
I don't know.
Right. So there is a mitzvah in the Torah. It's called Tashbitu. It's a positive command to destroy the chametz. There's a machloket, a debate in the Talmud. Can you just get rid of it? Do you actually have to burn it? There's two different opinions. We follow the opinion that says burning. If you physically can't burn it, your building is going to go crazy and you can't go to Central Park and find a little spot to burn it, then you can flush it down the toilet. That's okay too. All right? Just follow with me. Is this making sense, guys?
Yeah.
Okay. Sell the chametz to a non-Jew. We talked about that bedikat. So the night before the Seder, as soon as possible after nightfall... That's Sunday night. The head of the household takes a lit candle. And with the rest of the family searches out for any leftover chametz. Customary to place 10 pieces of bread. Search them out with a candle. A feather and wooden spoon are used to move the chametz found into a paper bag or plate. A blessing is said before the search is done. After the search, the chametz is wrapped, put aside in a safe place to be burned in the morning. A declaration is then made to annul ownership of any chametz still overlooked. And then burning is the next morning. It's wrapped and prepared the night before. It's taken burnt. Anybody would like, are you guys here? Is anyone here in the west side that Monday? There'll be a burning in the morning. Take a look. By the way, this packet is going to be your godsend for Passover. It's got everything in it that you wanted to know and didn't want to know. Take a look. Let's go through it quickly. Step one. 1 second. Actually, this is step 4. Search for chametz. The time for bedikah chametz is going to be Sunday night, April 21, after 8:12, is on page 10 of your packet. Sunday night, April 21, after 8:12. And you should try to begin your search immediately afterwards. There's the blessing. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu, al Bi'ur Chametz, which means on the burning even though you're just searching, because the goal is eventually to destroy it. You're searching for it to destroy it. And then you put away the 10 pieces of chametz, and then you do, at the conclusion of the search, you have the bittul. All chametz is placed in a known location, and a declaration, see below. That's step number four. If you literally just follow this packet, we spent a lot of time putting this packet together. I want to thank the Jewish Center. We used their packet and futzed around with it a little, but it's really so user-friendly, and it really helps. Step number five is the sell of chametz. Step six is the fast of firstborn. I'm going to go through all this quickly. Let's go back to step one. Any questions just about, just keep them confined to all of these little things that we're talking about right now, because we got a lot to cover. Any other questions about the search, the sale, the nullification, the burning? All make sense? Yes, please.
Step six is a question.
Step six is what?
The fast or the first?
I'll get to the fast. I'm going to get to it.
Why feather and a spoon?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think the spoon, because you burn it together. It's like something that easily burns. I don't know. I grew up with that also. My father used to put the. You don't really have to. I make the blessing over a candle, and then I blow out. I look a little with the candle, then I blow it out, and I use my flashlight because it's easier, and I don't want to. And curtains
you
to catch on
fire. Spoon and the feather also.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You don't have to though. Like I don't really use a spoon and a feather. You don't need to.
Amazon gave me one for $6, so I'll just burn it.
So, just burn it up.
Yeah. You bought that?
Yeah.
Okay.
To get free shipping.
How many of you guys, just by show of hands, want to have a kosher kitchen for Passover? When I say a kosher kitchen, I mean, want to cook in your kitchen for food you'll eat on Passover? Just, I'm curious. Yeah? Okay. Okay, it's enough. Fine. Because I wouldn't spend time if it was like, you're just going to order everything in. I'm a bachelor. I don't cook, you know, kind of thing. Fine. How do you make a kosher kitchen?
Boil.
Well, let's be very, very specific. You're going to boil the whole kitchen? What do you do? Just take a grenade?
Literally, yeah.
What do you do? How do you kosher your kitchen? So let's start with the oven. How do you kosher your oven?
Self-cleaning.
If you have self-cleaning, that's the trick. It's very easy. Put that sucker on, by the way. You don't have to clean it. You just put it. How many guys have self-cleanings? Okay. I'm going to start a support group. Oh, you don't have a self-cleaning.
I don't have myself.
It doesn't have an oven.
You have a self-cleaning?
I haven't used the oven, so
I don't know. By the way, I don't you know, when I was single, I lived with four guys in a one-bedroom apartment in the Heights. I lived for 3 years. I lived with four other guys. Five guys, one bedroom. And I moved into the kitchen because that's how often we use the kitchen. And the drawers, the cabinet drawers for the kitchen were where I kept my underwear and my clothing. And I used to keep stuff on the stove. I used to put stuff in the stove. That's how often. So I'm well aware, you know.
Did you have a bed?
What's that? My bed was in the kitchen.
Yeah, but you had a mattress.
No, I had a very nice room. I was the only one with my own room.
Oh, the rest
for 3 years. I'll show you the building in the Heights. You want to know what I paid?
Yeah. Probably.
$150 a month. That's just 27 years ago. Wow. $150 a month.
That's crazy. What did you do for food?
Eat out.
Two things. I ate out, and then my mother of blessed memory used to fill me up.
Aww.
With like stuff, leftovers. I used to go home sometimes on Shabbat, or I would just drive home. Mm-hmm. She'd pack it up. I had a microwave. I didn't have plates. I used to eat on paper. I remember it was whatever. This is what we did. So I'm very, you know, that's why I asked. Like, oh, you even need to do anything? Like, you just order it in? Okay. So self cleaning. If you don't have a self cleaning oven, how do you kosher it? It's very simple. Clean out your oven in the inside using some pungent item, right? Leave it for leave your oven for 24 hours. Make sure you don't use it for 24 hours. Clean it out really well, and then turn it on to its highest setting for an hour, and you've kosher it. The only pain is the cleaning. You got to really get in there and clean. That's why the self-cleaning saves you the time of the cleaning.
Yeah.
That's all. But otherwise, it's just cleaning it well, and including the racks and all that, whatever's in there, and then you just turn it on to its highest setting, which is like 550 or broil. Okay, the broil pans on the bottom. Anybody have like a broil? I feel like,
yeah.
I have to go like this in order to show you. The broil pans on the bottom.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't really kosher that unless you have a blowtorch. because you need direct flame. And by the way, I'm not making stuff up. I've been doing this for years, and I can show you all the sources in the Talmud of why we're doing this. Just trust me, because I don't want to keep you here all night. So that's the broiler. Just leave your broiler. Can you survive a week without your broiler? I think you can.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just curious. Isn't that the hottest part, though?
What?
The broil aspect.
Yeah, the problem, it is, but you're still not. The difference between a broiler, it'd be like koshering a barbecue. How do you kosher a barbecue? Okay, quickly. This is the central principle in koshering. My son is learning this in rabbinical school now. It's called kabolo, kach bolto. The way something gets absorbed is the way you expunge it. It's not hocus pocus. The way something gets absorbed into some metal is the way you pull it out. So if a barbecue, how did non-kosher meat or non-kosher for Passover meat get absorbed into your barbecue? What was the medium?
Heat.
But what kind of heat? Direct flame. You took the burger and you plopped it right on the grill. So in order to kosher that grill, you would need direct flame on there. But that's not the same thing. That's why we kosher our pots and pans not with direct flame. We immerse it in hot boiling vat of water. Or we put hot water in it and let it boil over. Because the way that pot became not kosher was not through direct heat of the red heat on it. It was through some other medium, which was water. Because you don't just cook something in a pot with nothing. There's butter, there's oil, there's water, there's something else. It's only a barbecue or a broiler pan where the food goes directly on it. Okay.
I see. Okay.
You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, what about the top of the stove? How do you kosher the top of your stove?
You light it?
Just turn it on. Want to get the grates red hot. Little trick to spread the fire around a little, take some heavy-duty tinfoil, and just put the heavy-duty tinfoil on top. And that spreads the flame. And that helps, basically, hello, welcome, that helps kashra. You just need to leave it there for about 15 minutes. Okay, and then you've kashra the top. What about the stuff in between the grates? Welcome, Dr. Ravina. What about the stuff in between the grates?
Oil.
You just cover it. You could theoretically kashra it, but it's a hassle. You'd have to clean it, and then you have to take boiling water and pour it over it, and then the water is going to kill your pilot light. So just leave it. So just you just cover it. And your stove will look like a spaceship a little. You know, if you put some tinfoil, on it a little. Okay, so that's how we kosher a stove. Any questions? Yeah.
Are we able to kosher the pots and pans?
Yes. How do you kosher a pot and pan or cutlery?
Buy new stuff.
You could either buy new stuff, you could use paper. What's that?
People buy new stuff.
Yeah, it's just easier. They're just trying to save money. They're not saving money. They're trying to save time. That's all.
You
just bring it to the mikvah, right? If you buy new stuff.
If you're buying new stuff and it's metal or glass, thank you, Will, it needs to be brought to the mikvah to be immersed in a mikvah right. That's a whole lot of mitzvah. What's that?
I have to do that.
Okay. I'll tell you how to kosher microwave in a second. It's all in here, by the way. Everything I'm saying is written up in this packet. Pots and pans. Anybody know how to kosher a pot? Don't use it for 24 hours then. Just make sure it hasn't been used for 24 hours.
Boil it.
Yeah, you boil water in it.
Right. Well, first make sure it's clean. Don't use it for 24 hours. But how do you boil it? Just take water and boil it, but you want to make sure that the water boils over the lip a little. So the way to get the water boiling is just have a lot of water, or a lot of people do is they take a rock with tongs, use tongs, and put it on the flame, let the rock get hot, and then when the water boils, just take the rock, put it on the surface, and it'll boil over. That koshers the lip where food gets as well. And that's how you kosher a pot. Once you've koshered a pot, keep that boiled water in there, and then you can kosher your cutlery by just placing one item in after the next, and just make sure, as long as the pot is large enough to have 60 units of water against the item that you're koshering, you're good. So any normal size pot should be able to kosher your cutlery. What if something is too big to be koshered? You could kosher it in stages. So if you have, let's say, this thing that I'm koshering in a bowl right here, and I can't get the whole thing in the bowl, I could kosher it like here, this part, and then pick it up, and then kosher the other part over here. You can do it that way as well. I'm happy to walk anyone through this. It's not rocket science. And most of the stuff is kosherable. The only thing we don't kosher is earthenware. So most plates and are things that we do not kosher for Passover. But most people's meat and dairy, whatever it is, plates. But pots and pans or anything metal can be koshered, just not earthenware. Anybody know why? Why don't we kosher earthenware? Because what?
The absorbance.
It's so absorbed. In other words, the chametz is so absorbed in it, no matter how much heat you apply, you can't really kind of remove it. Where do you have to actually clean in your home? Where do you have to clean? Where do you have to make sure you don't have chametz in your home?
Wherever you cook and eat.
Wherever you cook and eat. If you don't cook and eat, I mentioned this before, there's some room that you never bring food in. You don't have to do anything in that room. It's just for areas where there's food. Shopping for Pesach is important, and you want to look for a kosher for Passover label. You don't want to just look for a kosher label. You want to look for a kosher for Passover label. And if you look at page 8 of your packet, step number 3, what things don't need a kosher for Passover label? Anybody know? What
oil
does not require?
Oil.
Oil does. Oil needs a kosher for Passover label. Fruits, vegetables, potatoes, meat, poultry. Obviously, you want to buy meat and poultry in a kosher establishment. Fish and dairy products are permitted when in their pure form. If processed, then you have to find a kosher for Passover label. I'm reading the last paragraph from page 8. What's that? What'd you say?
Ice cream.
Everything needs a kosher for Passover except for potatoes, fruits, vegetables, meat, poultry.
What about milk?
So that's interesting. Before Passover, milk does not, but on Passover, it does. So if you're buying milk, let's say during Chol HaMoed, during the intermediate days, you should look for kosher for Passover. But before Passover, you don't, technically. And then you take a look at page 9. Prohibited foods include bread, cakes, biscuits, cereals, crackers, pasta, alcohol, vinegar made from these 5 grains. Most Ashkenazic authorities have added the following foods. They're called kidney oats, rice, corn, millet, string beans. I'm on the second paragraph. And legumes, and so on and so forth. What about medicine? What do we do with medicine? So take a look on top of page 9. Medicines, since chametz binding agents are used in many pills, the following guidelines should be followed. If the medicine is requiring, obviously, for life-sustaining therapy, there's no question to use it. If not, some authorities permit while some others prohibit. Okay, so I'm just telling you, a lot of us are starting out. I think you can rely on the more lenient opinion that says that once something is being used as just a binder in a medication, it no longer has a status of food and therefore is permissible. And I would say the same thing about cosmetics. You don't have to check your toothpaste that is kosher for Passover if you don't really consider toothpaste food, you know. But there are some people who are strict and because it does get a little consumed. But I'm just telling you, you have what to rely on that you don't have to be concerned about that. Take a look at page 9 on the bottom. Pesach labels no product can be used in Pesach unless it is accompanied by a reliable kosher Pesach label and endorsed by a rabbi whose name and location is clearly stated. A label reading simply for Passover and adorned with Jewish symbols not reliable. These guidelines do not cover a situation. Consult a rabbi. You know, if anyone wants to get in Rabbi Pinney's chat, they're already asking these questions. Can I eat? They're taking pictures of the back of the thing. Can I eat this? Can I eat that? And he's really good on this kind of stuff. It's a big deal. Let me reiterate what I always reiterate to you guys. Judaism is not an all or nothing proposition. Ask yourself, what can I do this year more than I did last year? Don't get overwhelmed and say, I need to do everything. But you want to try to stretch yourself a little more because it's a very important holiday. And the Torah is pretty explicit about like a lot of these things. I'll just tell you what I shared in the class before. It was that a lot of people, particularly American Jews, who were not that observant, would not keep a very observant home on Shabbat or didn't keep kosher all year, became very religious when it came to Passover. Mm-hmm. A lot of our bubbies and zadies would spend hours koshering everything and being very, very strict. And some of it is because the Torah seems to be very strict on chametz, you know, staying away from it, not having any benefit or pleasure from it and all that. And it's interesting, the Seder is the most widely observed Jewish ritual still in the United States. More Jews observe a Seder than any other Jewish ritual. So there's like an acknowledgement that there's some seriousness, I think, to this holiday. Any questions? Yeah, please.
Is Passover always in the spring? Because it always...
Yes, it's always in the spring. Next week, I'm going to go over with you some tips from the Seder. And does anybody know what on the Seder plate represents the springtime nature of Passover?
The egg.
Not as much the egg, but the parsley. A lot of people use for karpas. You can use a potato, but a lot of people use parsley or something green to express the springtime. What is springtime? Because you said rebirth. The Jewish people have been are started over. You know. Well, the egg is because the egg is supposed to represent the carbon chagiga. There were two offerings in the times of the temple. One was the Paschal offering, and the other one was another offering. And the egg represents the chagiga. What's that?
There's
the shank. But we're going to go through all that next week, though, about what to do at the Seder table and all that. Any questions about this, about your kitchens, about the searching for chametz, the nullifying chametz? So quickly, why do we nullify if we're searching? And why do we search if we're nullifying? Someone else besides Will. I know you guys are tired. What do you think? Josh, why do we nullify if we're searching? Why are we searching if we're nullifying?
We nullify just in case.
Just in case what?
Just in case we miss something.
Right. In case we missed something when we were searching. Good. And so why not search? Why don't we just nullify everything? I don't know if I answered this.
Well, it's a mitzvah to search and to find.
Okay, but the rabbis came up with that mitzvah. It's not a biblical mitzvah to search. It's a biblical prohibition to own chametz, but the mitzvah to search around your home the night before the Seder night, on Sunday night this year, that's of rabbinic origin. Why did the rabbis devise this? If you're going to do a bittul anyway, and you don't really own this stuff, so why do I have to search anyway? It's a very practical reason. I didn't give it before, so I'm putting you on the spot here. So what do you think? It's very practical, because just because you nullified something doesn't mean you're not going to eat that devil dog if you come across it.
Right.
So you could say, you know what, I'm not going to search for anything, I'm going to keep everything around, but I don't own it. But you still may eat it. See, that's another reason why the rules are so strict for Passover. All year round, if you keep kosher, that non-kosher food is taboo all year round. Passover, we take kosher food and we say, no, for 8 days. Yeah. Speaking of which, one last thing, and I take this for granted. Does everybody know when the holiday starts, the intermediary days, and then the holiday again at the end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the holiday starts Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday. That's the holiday. And MJ will be having services both of those days. Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning. You're all invited to come if you're around. And we'll be joining the Jewish Center for Monday night and Tuesday night services. Okay, the schedule is right in the packet here. What time? I think they're like 7. Oh, it says it. Tuesday night, 7:20. And then, Monday night, 7:30. And then Tuesday morning, back at MGE, 9:30. Wednesday night. And then Tuesday night, 7:20. And then Wednesday morning, 9:30. And then...
Does Yom Tov end Tuesday night?
So Yom Tov ends...
You can go to work?
No, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday. Yom Tov ends Wednesday night. Because 2 days. If you were in Israel, if we lived where we were supposed to be living, it would be
7 days.
No, Wednesday night. Because it starts Monday night.
No, I thought Monday night was the first day.
No, the first day is Thursday.
No. Sunday night is B'dikas Chametz.
Oh, I thought you meant at the end.
No, right. First days. I'm sorry. Thank you. So we're talking about the first days. Passover starts Monday night. Tuesday day, that's day one. Tuesday night, Wednesday is day two. And then you have what's called, how do you say it in Hebrew, the intermediary days?
Yom Tov.
No?
Wait, what?
What is Yom Tov? No, let's get the terms, guys. Yom Tov is what?
Monday.
Is the holiday. When's the holiday start?
22nd.
Give me days.
Sundown,
Monday night.
Sundown.
Tuesday day. That's Yom Tov day one.
And then Wednesday.
Wednesday end. Tuesday night, Wednesday day, Yom Tov day two. And then what starts Tuesday night?
Counting the
I'm sorry, not Tuesday night. Okay, let's just put that aside. we'll do that. What starts Wednesday night? Chol Hamoed. What's Chol Hamoed, guys? In between days. What's the deal with in between days? Can you drive? Can you cook? You can do all that.
Do.
But you're supposed to dress a little nicer, and you're supposed to.
Do you put the phone on in the intermediate?
So I do. There are different customs. Most people don't.
Mm-hmm.
But our family tradition, we do.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chol Hamoed goes till Shabbat. So Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday. And then you have Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another day of Chol Hamoed after Shabbat, Saturday night, Sunday. Because the second days of Yom Tov start when? Sunday night, the next week. Okay? Can you see this in your head?
Mm-hmm.
Sunday night, next week, and just two more days then. So basically it's holiday and then in between the intermediary days. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, it's a big deal. It's a lot of holidays. It's a lot of time from work. I always say this to people, try to do your best to take off as much as you can. If you can't take off both days or you're not ready to do that religiously, spiritually, which is a better day to take off, the first or the second?
The second?
Not of the 2 days, meaning of each of the two sets.
Yeah, first day.
First day.
The first day, why?
Because you're going to be hungover from the four glasses.
anybody know why?
Because you're out, and
you
don't,
because that's everyone
doesn't
know. You want to start off right?
No.
I think it's more like the two sets, like the first two.
Yeah, the first
days.
Oh, first 2 days are important.
The first 2 days,
the
second 2 days. If you can only take off of the first 2 days, the first, one of those two,
oh.
Or you can only of the one of the other two on the other side. Which would be better from a halachic? Why day
first.
One?
Seder.
There are a lot of mitzvahs involved that we're supposed to.
You can still go to the seder if you're working. You're going to at night. What's that?
It's like, is it rabbinic the second day? Because
rabbinic the second day is rabbinic.
The
right, and we're only observing them in the diaspora. I'm not saying they're not important. They are important, and the mainstream community observes both. But I'm saying if you're at a stage where like you're starting to do this and you can't do that, you want to take one step, start with the first day. That's what I always tell people.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, okay. Dr. Adina, what else, what did I miss here?
The fast part.
Oh, one last thing. How many people are firstborn males? Whoa, a lot of firstborn males. So.
Firstborn and male. Like the firstborn child.
And male, yes,
yeah.
Correct.
That's a lot of
identify yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the deal? You're supposed to fast what day?
Erev.
Why? It's true. When is Erev? That would be Monday.
Monday.
You're supposed to fast Erev, the holiday, before the holiday. Why?
Because there's slaying of the firstborn.
Yeah.
The slaying of the firstborn took place then, and God passed over and saved the firstborn male Jewish boys. So a lot of people don't want to fast. What do you do to get around the fast?
Siyum.
Go to a siyum. What's a siyum?
Finishing like a tractate.
Right, finishing a tractate. Once you're going to a siyum, how could you not eat if you're at a siyum? It's okay to eat if you're not at a siyum. So conveniently, it just happens to be that their Jewish center will be having, it's a joke, all synagogues make siyums, and they try to get somebody in the community to finish a tractate at that time. There will be a siyum here at the Jewish Center downstairs on the first floor. Take a look at the schedule. You see the schedule in the beginning. Leah did a great job on this. When is the siyum? On Monday. Come to the morning service at 7:15, and then followed by a siyum. So if you don't want to pray beforehand, get here by 7:45. For the siyum. By the way, it takes all 5 minutes, so don't miss it, or else you won't be able to eat.
Mark, according to Rabbi Avadia Yosef, firstborn women should be tested.
Should also? He holds that.
He gave a dispensation for pregnant women.
So is that mainstream? Do people do this? Do you fast?
Nothing.
No, so you know what? There
But why? Can I ask you a question? I thought only the boys were threatened because.
Okay, because it's based on a midrash. It says that the men were threatened physically, but the women were threatened spiritually.
Oh, wow.
The idea was that the women were going to marry Egyptian men and then you'd wipe out Judaism. So that they were targeted, the way they read it.
Really?
Way. There's like an allusion to it, I think, in the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, nobody really does it, except I did it. Like, I made sure to go to this in 1 year. Because when I was pregnant with our first child, when I was, when our son, what was it? I think when he was born, I can't remember, so he couldn't fast, and my husband is a firstborn.
Uh-huh.
So you the mom then they say sometimes goes for
fast for the boy.
Fast for
okay, because until he's like 8 or 10,
right,
he's not
right,
going to fast.
Yeah, but there was a reason.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
All right, firstborn males. Let's give it up for firstborn males
and girls.
Yeah. Okay. If anybody would like to kasher the kitchen, we could either come over and do it with you, or we can walk you through it. If you and by the way, what about other things in the kitchen? What do you do with your fridge? You don't have to kasher the fridge. You just clean it out so that there's no chametz sticking onto anything. And you can actually keep chametz in the fridge that you're selling if you just put it someplace and put something over it so you don't inadvertently take it. You could leave the chametz in the fridge also if you need it too. If there's something that needs to be refrigerated, you don't want to get rid of. That makes sense?
To do, I don't think so, but like the koshering and going to a mikvah, immersion,
mm-hmm.
like is that necessary or no?
For anything that is metal or glass and manufactured by someone not Jewish.
Right, but so like it's stuff that you've had and it's like be a pot, like that you've koshered.
Yeah.
Okay, so
and
you
has
also
it been,
have to go to mikvah too?
Well, has it been brought to the mikvah already?
You've already gone to the mikvah.
No, then
okay,
you don't,
yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah,
no, no, you just have to kosher it. That's
yeah.
a good question.
Yeah.
So you would only bring stuff to the mikvah that's basically new.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
And only metal and glass, not like ceramic or anything like that.
Wait, so if you have to like kosher or something because like it's status change and you mixed it up or something, you don't have to go back to the mikvah?
No.
Okay, I don't think I know.
Right.
Cool, awesome.
I looked it up because now I remember. I only found out about this after my son was like 10 years old. That if your husband is a firstborn and your child, your son, you have a son who's a firstborn, the mother should go
mm-hmm.
until the boy is bar mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
So when I found out about it, because I wasn't familiar with that, then I went every year
to a Siyum.
To a Siyum.
Has anyone been to? Oh, we had one here. We had some Siyums here. They're great. All right, guys, take a 5-minute break, and then you've got Dr. Adina for an amazing class. What are you covering, Dr. Adina?
Spiritual tips and answers.
Seders. Oh, excellent. Okay, good. You're going to make you sound really smart at your Seder. How many guys are leading your own Seder? Anybody? Will? Yeah?
Maybe. Yeah.
But you want to be able to say something. You don't want to just sit
I led
there.
I it last year.
Did, wow.
I mean, my dad let me lead.
Okay. But this way you'll be able to, you'll have some real pearls of wisdom to be able to share.
My dad said, you started going back to synagogue, you take this over.
It's all yours.
It's all yours.
It's all yours. Yeah, that's great. Well, it should be beautiful. What do we say to each other?